Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be looking back to the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower and the way that he dealt with the issue of civil rights. 50 years ago, Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, became the first battleground for desegregation after the Supreme Court struck down the concept of separate but equal. This happened a period of three weeks in September 57, when the governor of Arkansas, Orville Faubus, blocked nine black students from enrolling at the all-white school. In response, the president, Dwight Eisenhower, sent the 101st Airborne to integrate the high school, making it one of the biggest and perhaps first battles of the civil rights movement, and making Eisenhower perhaps, arguably, the first civil rights president. We're talking this morning with Casey Pipes. He has authored a book which explores this subject. The title of his book is Ike's Final Battle, The Road to Little Rock and the Challenge of Equality. World Ahead is the publisher. Casey Pipes worked in the Bush White House. He's been a speechwriter for the governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger. He also was the chief author of the 204 Republican Party National Platform. He now serves as president of the Pipes Company. It's a corporate communications consulting firm. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief so that we can keep moving along, but anyone's welcome to call. Mr. Pipes, hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for calling. Thank you for being with us, I should say. You know, I think the thing probably that attracted me to the book and to doing the show, I think, was the opportunity to spend some time talking about Dwight Eisenhower, because I know that there are a lot of people, historians, people who write about American politics, who feel that that Eisenhower has been undervalued, has been underappreciated as an American president. Now, here in the prologue to the book, you say that you think of this book perhaps as being an unconventional biography which looks at Mr. Eisenhower and his life through basically concentrating on one issue, that is race. So maybe as a way to start, I might ask about why, first of all, why it is that you decided that you wanted to spend some significant time thinking about and writing about Dwight Eisenhower, but why it is then you picked this particular issue to be the main focus of the work.
Well, it's fascinating to me to compare these two great forces. I mean, there are two great stories that emerge during the post-World War II era. One is Dwight Eisenhower, whose star is as big as anybody's in the world. He's the hero of D-Day. He's the man who destroyed Hitler. And he's almost destined for the White House the minute the shooting of World War II stops. The other great story, of course, is the Civil Rights Movement, which also gets its momentum from the successes of World War II, from the exploits of black troops in World War II. And there's actually some interesting cross-sections there with General Eisenhower that I talk about in the book. So I was fascinated by this cross-section. As I say in the book, this is the story of the greatest American hero of his time dealing with the greatest American dilemma of all time. Here you have Dwight Eisenhower wrestling with the drive for equality in America. And it was a challenge that the Founding Fathers obviously struggled with. Lincoln struggled with race. FDR, Truman. I mean, this had been the profound dilemma of American democracy. And in the 1950s, it falls to the hero of D-Day to try his hand at it. He does struggle. He does get some things wrong. But as I document in the book, he actually deserves a little bit more credit than he's been given thus far.
I think that some people might make the argument that, and not taking anything away from the way that he dealt with this issue, but I think, as you said, in a sense, that that this was, he didn't exactly seek out this fight, and yet it was thrust upon him. So one might say, yes, he dealt with it pretty admirably, particularly for a person of his time, but was, in fact, civil rights something that was that was highly placed on his agenda, or did he in fact end up having to deal with this because a couple of years now before what we're talking about here, the Supreme Court handed down the Brown v. Board decision, and sooner or later you knew that this was going to come to a head?
Well, and that's one of the questions I try to deal with in the book, because until now everyone has basically said, all the scholars who have looked at this have said, he really didn't care about the issue. I actually found something different in my research. I think that he did care about the issue, particularly as president. The question was approach. The question was means, not the ends. How do we get from here to there? And here's the dilemma that he faced as a political leader in America. How do you promote minority rights in a country governed by majority rule? And it was not at all clear in the early 1950s that the majority of Americans wanted major social change on this issue. So how do you move forward in a way that respects and promotes the rights of minorities, but also respects the opinion of the majority? But don't just take my word on that. Martin Luther King, who had significant correspondence with Eisenhower throughout his presidency and met with him, said that Eisenhower on the civil rights issue was very sincere. However, he said that Eisenhower wanted to go about it in a very incremental approach, and I agree with that. My research showed him to be a small-c conservative, that being he wanted to move step-by-step over time, and he favored evolution to revolution. And so you have this interesting cross-section of Eisenhower and the civil rights movement having the same goals, more or less, but having different approaches to getting there. And that makes the story all the more interesting.
Yeah. One of the things that I wonder about, and I'm sure that people would think about, it was a few years ago that we marked the anniversary of the Brown decision of the Supreme Court. This happened the decision itself came down in 1954. So now here are the events that we're talking about here are 1957, when this was in a sense the fulfillment of Brown, although maybe you'd say it was the first step in the fulfillment of Brown. Why it took so long after Brown for this first big test actually to take place?
Well, because that's the instructions that the Supreme Court gave. As you recall, they issued their order in 1954, and then in 1955 they came back in a separate ruling, which was basically an implementation ruling, and said that local school districts throughout the South should put together desegregation plans with all deliberate speed, was their famous phrase. Mm-hmm. Incidentally and ironically, the Eisenhower administration had filed a brief in the second case as well as the first case. But in the second case, they actually argued for a 90-day period. So they actually wanted them to get moving even quicker on this. But nevertheless, the Supreme Court wanted to give lots of flexibility to the South. This was a huge revolutionary change in the way schools were run. So they wanted to afford them some flexibility. And by 1957, school districts were beginning to put in place integration plans, and Little Rock was one of them. They were ready to move forward in September of 57 with a plan to integrate Central High School, which was the showpiece of their school district, with nine carefully chosen African-American children who had agreed to do this. And hence, you have the makings of the showdown in September of 57 between Eisenhower and Democratic Governor Orville Faubus. Mm-hmm.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Casey Pipes, he is the author of the book Ike's Final Battle. The subtitle is The Road to Little Rock and the Challenge of Equality. And as he explains in the book, it is a biography of Dwight Eisenhower. He calls it an unconventional biography that looks at Eisenhower basically through this one issue, concentrating on his approach to this one particular issue, that is the issue of civil rights. World Ahead is the publisher. I'm sure you can find it in a bookstore. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Would you, if you look back at Eisenhower's youth, would you say that that he had much in the way of personal experience with African Americans any more than the average white person of his day would have?
No, he didn't. He was a very conventional man in many ways. He's born in Denison, Texas. He's raised in rural Kansas. He's a product of West Point and the Army culture. Interestingly, there are a couple of episodes where he encounters African Americans as a child, one of which is when his football team, I believe in high school, was playing another team from another town, and there was a black kid on the other team, and Eisenhower's teammates refused to play. And Eisenhower sort of talks them into playing and makes a point of shaking the opposing player, the African-American player's hand. So we see signs early on in his life of pretty good intentions, of his basic decency. However, I think the Army culture itself sucked him in a little bit. As a young officer, we see him showing very typical, what we would now call typical military views of his era regarding black troops. And one episode I recount in the book is, as a young officer at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio in 1916, he's asked to train some National Guard troops from Illinois, actually. And they are African-American troops posted to Fort Sam Houston. And Eisenhower is unimpressed, and he says that he takes it for granted. He says this years later, but he said, "I took it for granted that they couldn't shoot because they were stupid." And this is sort of typical of his views on black soldiers all the way up until World War II, and World War II changes him dramatically. Mm-hmm. And I document that in the book. I spend a lot of time talking about his dealings with African-American troops in World War II because he changes his mind. It changes him, particularly the Battle of the Bulge, where he desperately needs more troops, and there's a War Department policy prohibiting black infantry troops at the front. Eisenhower essentially rescinds that order. A number of African-Americans volunteer for combat service. He watches them perform very well and says later to an aide, "That was a turning point. I saw how stupid segregation was. It kept me from having great troops at the front, and the black troops performed as well as the white troops." So World War II changes him, and he's never quite the same again. It also, incidentally, changes the civil rights movement. Black troops who went to the front of the line in battle were not eager to go to the back of the bus in Birmingham when they came home. And so you see the civil rights movement post-World War II begin to really move forward with a force and a momentum that it hadn't had before. And so both of these events, the rise of Eisenhower and the rise of the civil rights movement, are sort of produced by World War II, and they climax, I believe, in the 50s, and it makes for a very compelling story.
Well, as you say, that here his attitudes towards African Americans changed dramatically watching them fight in World War II, and that this is something that this decision to put them into combat was something that, again, he was, in a sense, he was backed into a corner because the Allied forces, they needed troops. They needed everybody they could possibly get. They could put a gun into their hands and get them in there. And for that reason, he did this. He might not have otherwise. How exactly did he make this decision? Was it very difficult? Did he spend a lot of time thinking about it? Did he consult with other people? How did that come about?
Well, as you say, it was born of necessity, and he did think about it quite a bit. It's interesting, you see at the Battle of the Bulge some of the hesitation that scholars have always criticized him for in later years. The Battle of the Bulge, in many ways, is sort of a pre-season version of the civil rights battles he faced in the 50s. He wants to do the right thing. He has the right instinct, but he hedges a bit. And let me explain that. He sends out an order to the troops in late 1944, as the bulge is raging and the Germans are surging forward in the Ardennes. And he sends out this order, and it says, if you're an African-American soldier, you can come forward, we'll give you combat training, and we'll send you to the front, and you can serve, and these were his words, shoulder to shoulder with your white comrades. Well, he sends out the order, and there's sort of this uprising from white officers, including his chief of staff, Beadle Smith. And they urge him to reconsider the policy. He doesn't reconsider the policy necessarily. He does tone it down a bit. And a new executive order goes out that rather than offering the chance to serve shoulder to shoulder, nonetheless offers black troops the chance to serve in black units at the front. So they won't be in white units, but they will be in black units. They will be at the front. And that is a huge leap forward because War Department policy, as written by George Marshall, had not allowed that at this point. And so that's what happens. A number of them volunteer, they're organized, they're sent to the front. The bulge ends, by the way, before their training is over, so they don't actually serve in the bulge, but they serve in subsequent battles, and they do quite well. And he notices it, and he praises them, and he's very impressed by it. So he does have the right instincts. He does listen, however, to the complaints of other people, and he does sort of try to find a middle ground, try to find a compromise. And we see that pattern repeat itself again during the White House years. But nonetheless, the real impact, I think, of the bulge was the fact that the troops did come forward, they did perform well, and it did change his mind.
Hmm. And now, I guess we should point out that, in fact, though, for until a couple of years after the war, the military was still officially segregated, and that didn't change. That did not end until 1948, and that was Harry Truman signed that order officially outlawing racial segregation in the military. What did Eisenhower think about that?
Well, it's interesting because in some ways I think my book is the first to sort of show the connection between Eisenhower's actions at the Bulge and Truman. We tend to think that Truman acted in a vacuum, and while he certainly acted heroically in issuing Executive Order 9981, desegregating the military in July of 1948, he did not act in a vacuum. It was the direct result of a chain of events. After Eisenhower used black troops at the front successfully, there were a number of studies that were conducted. One was the Gillum Report, and then one was the Charles Wilson Report that the Truman Administration commissioned, both of which went back and studied World War II and decided, hey, you know what, this worked. The black troops did well. There didn't seem to be a violent reaction from white troops, and we should think about doing this permanently. And so in many ways, again, the momentum created by World War II and by Eisenhower's own decisions sort of led to the Truman Executive Order. Nevertheless, Eisenhower still shows kind of cautious feelings in the late 40s as the integration movement is moving forward. He gives a testimony to Congress in 48 in which he appears to hedge. He basically talks about how his experiment had worked and black troops were very brave and noble, but we needed to integrate basically in a slow way, in a way that was consistent with the goals of the Army. And many of the Southern congressional leaders who opposed integration seized upon this and almost quoted him out of context in some ways and used this to say that he didn't really support integration. But nevertheless, Truman issues the executive order. The military drags its feet, I believe, I argue in the book, for a number of years. And so by the time Eisenhower becomes president in 1953, even though a desegregated military is the law of the land, you still have a segregated military. And it's really Eisenhower in 1953 who goes about the business of integrating the military, of enforcing the Truman executive order, and in pretty short order, in large part because of his great war persona and his stature, the military is integrated, and that's really one of his first civil rights achievements as president.
Yeah. Just as you say, because of his leadership in the Allied war effort against the Nazis, Eisenhower was a great hero. He, I think, safe to say, probably one of the most admired Americans of his time. So perhaps not surprising that people would think about him, the possibility of having him for high office. On the other hand, I suppose some people would say that while he might have been tested in battle, he'd never been in politics. He'd never run for office. How did people think that initially about the idea of Dwight Eisenhower as a candidate for the presidency?
Well, he was recruited by both parties, as you know, and he was, as you say, very widely respected, arguably the most famous man in the world. And it's very hard. One of the challenges writing this book was to create for the reader a sense of the aura Eisenhower had, because we don't have Eisenhowers today. We haven't had Eisenhowers since Eisenhower. I mean, he was bigger than life. He was worldwide known, the man who saved civilization, the man who liberated the camps, the concentration camps. I mean, his stature was second to none. And I use a couple of anecdotes in the book to describe his stature, one of which is Norman Rockwell, the famous painter, who was invited to a White House dinner with Eisenhower, and he's so terrified of being in the presence of the hero of D-Day that he goes to his doctor and he gets a prescription of barbiturates to calm his nerves. This is the effect Eisenhower had on people. They were just in awe of him. And so both parties clamored for his services. Both parties wanted him to run for president. And in 1952, he declares himself a Republican and runs for the presidency. And the real challenge is getting the nomination. I think everybody understood if he can get the nomination from Robert A. Taft in 1952, he can win the general election going away, which he does, and really becomes one of the most admired presidents in his time. I mean, for 8 years, people are generally pretty satisfied that you know, maybe we don't agree with everything he's doing, but this is a great man in the Oval Office, and we trust his judgment, and we trust his instincts. And we probably haven't had a president like that since him.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Casey Pipes. He is the author of a book, which he calls an unconventional biography of Dwight Eisenhower that concentrates largely on one particular issue, and that is civil rights. The book is Ike's Final Battle. The subtitle is The Road to Little Rock and the Challenge of Equality. It's published by World Ahead, and it takes a look at, closely at these events that center on September of 1957, when the governor of Arkansas blocked the entry of 9 black students to all-white Central High School. And as a result, Dwight Eisenhower sent in troops to integrate the school. And the story is told in this book. And if you're interested, you can head out to the bookstore and look for the book. Otherwise, questions here on the show are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Once Eisenhower becomes the nominee, it's settled that he will be the Republican candidate, and people talked about issues, was there much discussion about civil rights as an important issue?
There was, and again, it's fascinating to watch Eisenhower sort of work his way through the issue. As I say in the book, I'm less concerned in writing this with the policy making than I am with the soul searching. I mean, how did he wrestle with this issue? What was important to him? What was he trying to accomplish? And we see that throughout the war years. We also see it on the campaign trail. He meets with the NAACP in August of 1952, and he pledges to desegregate the District of Columbia, which he subsequently does. The District of Columbia at that time was one of the most segregated cities in America. He pledges to finish the job, as I mentioned, of desegregating the military, which he subsequently does. He pledges to have access to civil rights leaders. But the one area where he sort of comes up short in the NAACP's view is on what was considered a Federal Employment Practices Commission. This would be a federal group that would deal with discrimination in the workplace, in the private workplace, throughout America. And Eisenhower, though sympathetic, tells them he wouldn't support a federal version of it, he would support state versions of it. He's very much a federalist. He believes in limited government and the division of powers between the federal and the state government, and he feels that employment is an issue that is best dealt with at the state level. Well, this gets him into some trouble with the NAACP because this is a very important issue. This is the issue to them. And if you don't support a federal employment practices commission, then they're a little suspicious of you on anything else. And so he sort of, almost from the beginning, has an uneasy relationship with the NAACP. But he campaigns on the issue. He gives speeches on the issue. He goes to Harlem in October of 1952 and is sharply critical of the Democratic ticket, which consists of Adlai Stevenson of Illinois and John Sparkman as the vice presidential candidate of Alabama. And Sparkman was an unreconstructed Southern Dixiecrat in many ways, and Eisenhower calls him out on it and quotes back to his African-American audience in Harlem some of Senator Sparkman's own words opposing civil rights and talks about how, you know, this is what the other team offers you, and we offer you something much better. So race was very much an issue in 52, and Eisenhower didn't shy away from it.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Other folks who are listening, by the way, are welcome with their questions. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana listeners. So if you're here where we are, use that number. Otherwise, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Caller is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, I'm calling. I just came in on a conversation, but if it's about Little Rock, Arkansas, I have more than a passing interest in it. And since I grew up in a city about 100 miles southwest of Little Rock, and Little Rock was always on the racial compass of African Americans in Arkansas, especially with Orville Faubus doing what he did. My question to you, however, is the things you say about Dwight Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, and his race record, I have trouble dealing with that. I also was in the military, and I just read a book about military segregation is one of the things that kept blacks back, and Eisenhower was a 4-star and then a 5-star general, and I don't see any great efforts that he and Omar Bradley and those guys did to eliminate overt Jim Crow in the military. I have problems because I had heard, at least anecdotally, that Eisenhower's major concern about Little Rock Central was not so much integrating it, but the fact that a Southern governor was so opposed to federal power, and as a five-star general, Eisenhower thought that was an abomination. I do recall that Eisenhower, after Earl Warren was appointed to Chief Justice by Eisenhower and had the Warren Court, which did so many things for African-Americans, once said one of the first mistakes he made was appointing former Governor Earl Warren as Chief Justice of the United States. I have problems other than political opportunism of accepting the racial legacy of Eisenhower as being something good and from an African-American perspective. Will you comment on that?
I'd be happy to. Let me start with the first question, which was his military career. You may have missed the earlier part of our conversation, but we talked about the Battle of the Bulge, which may well be the single most important step forward for African-Americans in military service. And because of the executive order that Eisenhower issued at the Bulge, allowing African-Americans to serve at the front in infantry units against War Department policy. Remember, George Marshall very much opposed this, and yet Eisenhower went forward with it. Because they did serve, because they served so well, that led to the Gillum Report after the war, which documented the success of the experiment of black troops at the front, which led to the Charles Wilson Report, which led to Truman's executive order. So did Eisenhower set out to change the military culture and have a social revolution? Probably not. And I'm very careful not to claim too much for him on that. But did his actions have a profound impact on the events that led to an integrated military after the war? They absolutely did. I think the other issue you raised was Warren. That's probably one of the greatest urban myths of the whole Eisenhower record. I found nothing in the archives to indicate that he had ever said it was the biggest mistake he ever made. I know Herbert Brownell, his attorney general, who was famously a progressive on civil rights, he also investigated the record at length and interviewed a number of people who supposedly had heard Eisenhower say this. No one remembered that he ever said that. What he did, however, have sort of a falling out with Warren, but it wasn't over civil rights. It was actually over a series of law and order cases. And remember, in the Brown case itself in 1954, Brownell meets with Eisenhower in the lead-up to the oral arguments and convinces Eisenhower that the administration should submit a brief, a legal brief, on behalf of the NAACP position, which they did. And then in the subsequent court case, the 1955 Brown II ruling, where the court gave instructions on implementing the Brown ruling, there was yet again another Eisenhower briefing filed on behalf of the NAACP, urging that Southern school districts desegregate or have desegregation plans drawn up within 90 days, which is far more progressive than what the court ruled. The court ruled all deliberate speed. I think the last question you asked was about Little Rock, and Eisenhower certainly had very mixed feelings about Little Rock, but it wasn't because he doubted the justness of what was going on, and he didn't merely... I know David Halberstam, for example, wrote in his book that very much what you just said, that this was a five-star general and he didn't like being pushed around by a second lieutenant, Orville Faubus. I found very little evidence of that. I found a very, very consistency of thought from Eisenhower from the very beginning, not just that he was preserving law and order. He never said that, and that's one of the myths about his action at Little Rock. But that the federal court had spoken. The federal courts had said that integration was going to go forward. Little Rock had a plan. Faubus had been ordered by the federal court in Little Rock to stop, to cease and desist. He hadn't. And therefore, it was the executive's obligation to enforce the law, which, in fact, was integration in this case. Now, did he have mixed feelings about it? He absolutely did. He considered the thought of sending troops into an American city to be the absolute worst thing a president could have to do. And I think any president would feel the same way. If you send troops into a city, you might have an American citizen get hurt. And it was gut-wrenching for him. He said later that his decision at Little Rock was as hard as D-Day. But just so you know, the book is not at all a Valentine to Eisenhower. This is not an uncritical look. This is a balanced look that shows both his doubts and his hopes, his failures and his successes. And I think, on the whole, he comes out better than he's been given credit for. But the real heroes of the Civil Rights Movement are the Little Rock Nine, or Dr. King, or Thurgood Marshall. And I make that pretty clear in the book.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other calls, questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'd like to have you talk a little bit about the relationship between President Eisenhower and Adam Clayton Powell.
Yeah.
He was a member of Congress. He was a liberal Democrat and was probably, in his time, was probably the best known African-American politician in the United States. And you would think that these two men, because of their political orientations, would not be natural allies. What was the relationship between the two of them?
Well, I mean, surprisingly, it was quite good. Powell had had a very tumultuous relationship with the Truman White House. I think it's safe to say that he greatly disliked Truman. He felt that he was a Southern racist from Missouri who frequently used the N-word, which he did, and that, you know, even though he did some good things, such as the executive order on desegregating the military, he was not somebody that Powell felt close to or comfortable with. Eisenhower, on the other hand, Powell, partly because I think he liked him and admired him, but also partly because Powell was a great politician, he saw a chance to deal with him. This was a new administration. It was the first Republican in 20 years, even though Powell was a Democrat. He saw a chance to sort of leverage that and not only have a relationship with the new White House, but maybe get some things done. And so Powell works very closely with Max Rabe, who is basically Eisenhower's designated staffer on civil rights issues. Powell gives a number of speeches extolling the virtues of Eisenhower's first couple of years in office, when he finished desegregating the military, when he desegregated the District of Columbia. Powell praises these actions profusely in public and in print. And then in 1956, he goes one step further and actually endorses Eisenhower for president, meets with him in the Oval Office, and goes out on the stump for him and campaigns for him. I think for his part, Eisenhower was willing to deal with Powell, but he thought he was a little much. He thought he was a bit extravagant, which Powell was, and wasn't quite sure what to make of him. But nevertheless, you know, politics makes for strange bedfellows, and I document in the book how Powell, this very over-the-top political figure from New York, came to deal with this sort of very ordinary salt-of-the-earth guy from Abilene, Kansas, and they actually worked together fairly well. Hmm.
As you said, the decision, Eisenhower's decision to send troops, was not something that he did easily or lightly, and you do have to keep in mind that is an extraordinary exercise of power by a president to do such a thing. This is not the kind of thing that you're going to do lightly. When it became obvious that there was this deadlock, and that Governor Faubus had set up his position and he was not about to allow the black students to enroll in the school, was there some attempt by the White House and by the president to, in a quiet way, to sit down with the governor and say, look, we've got to find some way to work this out?
There was, and he did. As I say in the book, what began for me as a case study of Little Rock transformed, as I researched it and wrote it, into a character study of leadership. How did Eisenhower deal with a political crisis? We all know how he dealt with D-Day, with a military crisis and World War II and the Battle of the Bulge, but how did he deal with a domestic crisis like this? And it's fascinating to watch him work his way through the issue using many of the same skills he used as a general. Above all, he was always the calmest person in the room. He always wanted to meticulously work the problem, to to go through every possible option short of military force. Being a soldier, he knew that the military should always be the last option. And that's what he did at Little Rock. He tried very patiently to work the problem, and that included meeting with Faubus, which he did on September 14, 1957, in Newport, Rhode Island. He was staying in Newport for a vacation. And Faubus, I think very early on in this crisis, Faubus realizes that Eisenhower is his only hope. He, I think, realizes that the federal court in Little Rock is not messing around with him. Once Faubus sends out the National Guard troops and stops the integration of the nine African-American kids, he basically is in violation of federal law. And the federal court makes that very clear to him, that he needs to cut it out and cut it out soon. So Faubus appeals to Eisenhower. He begins corresponding with him, and these hysterical telegrams would talk about how, you know, he was, the FBI was tapping his phones, and he was trying to stop mob violence, which we now know from the archives, in many ways, Faubus helped organize the mob violence as a pretext for sending out National Guard troops and stopping integration. And Eisenhower, in his responses to Faubus, was very calm, but very direct. And Eisenhower would say to him, as he did in a famous exchange on September 5th, "The only assurance I can give you is that the federal Constitution will be upheld by every legal means at my command." And he also goes on to point out to Faubus that the National Guard troops that are keeping the nine black kids out of the school actually belong to the federal government and can be taken away from Faubus at any time. So, I mean, he's making none too thinly veiled threats to Faubus that he needs to get in line and do the right thing. They agree to have a meeting on September 14th, and again, Eisenhower is extraordinarily direct and blunt with Faubus and tells him that there's only one outcome when a Southern governor defies federal law, and that is for the federal government to settle it, and that Faubus is going to be humiliated, and that he has no interest in seeing that happen. Why don't you go back to Arkansas? Why don't you change the orders of the National Guard troops so that they not only stop mob violence, but they now protect the nine kids and take them and escort them into the school? And Eisenhower always thought that Faubus had agreed to that. And, of course, he was fooled, or not fooled, but he was disappointed because Faubus went back and did no such thing. And at that point, Eisenhower begins to realize the only thing that's going to settle this is if we send U.S. troops down there. And so eventually on September 24th, he does that. He federalizes the Arkansas National Guard. He sends in the 101st Airborne, arguably the most prestigious military unit in the U.S. arsenal. And in very short order, the nine African-American kids go into the school, the mobs disperse, and the crisis at Little Rock subsides. And, of course, it has profound consequences for integration going forward. As I say in the book, if integration had failed at Little Rock, it's hard to imagine how it could have prevailed anywhere else. But because the federal government intervened at the point of a bayonet, literally, it ensured that resistance to integration was futile and that integration was going to succeed in the 50s and 60s as it did. So it's a huge moment in the civil rights story, and just a tremendously dramatic story. I mean, the scene of the mob and the troops and the African-American kids and the contest of wills between the federal and the state government, I mean, it's a very, very compelling drama.
Let me just quickly introduce again our guest, Casey Pipes. He's the author of the book Ike's Final Battle, The Road to Little Rock and the Challenge of Equality, published by World Ahead Publishing. Casey Pipes worked in the Bush White House. He's written speeches for California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. He was the chief author of the 2004 Republican Party National Platform. He now serves as president of his own corporate communications consulting firm. The book is just recently published, and if you're interested in reading more, you can go out and take a look at it. Questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The events that we're talking about take place in September, September 57. And you note in the book that earlier, a couple of months earlier in the summer, in July, at a press conference, a reporter asked the president, asked Mr. Eisenhower directly whether he would consider using the military to enforce desegregation. And he said, Quote, I can't imagine any set of circumstances that would ever induce me to send federal troops. So, and I think that some people might find grounds to criticize him and say that if he earlier on, as things were moving closer and closer to the showdown, if he at some point had made a stronger statement about his commitment to desegregation, or might have said what he would be likely to do, that maybe that this the standoff, this dramatic thing that we have talked about, wouldn't have had to happen if he had taken a tougher stand earlier on and said, no, this is what we're going to do, and I'm not going to stand for anybody standing in the way, and I'm going to the full extent exercise the power of the federal government to see that what's right is what is done.
Well, and that's exactly one of the criticisms that was made at the time, and it's been made in years since. And one of the people who made that criticism was Chief Justice Warren, as we talked about with your caller earlier. Warren always said, and he said it in his memoirs and he said it in private, that he wished Eisenhower would have said more favorable things earlier on about the Brown ruling. Warren thought that if Eisenhower had come out in 1954 and said, this is a wonderful ruling, it's about time, and let's all do the right thing and support this ruling, in Warren's mind, it might have prevented a little rock. Eisenhower viewed, again, his role as chief executive a little differently. As he often said, he didn't think it was his job to comment on specific cases, although, as I mentioned, he filed a brief on behalf of the NAACP position. He viewed his job as enforcement, and he said a couple of days after the Brown ruling, that basically, and he said this in public, it doesn't matter what I think about it. What matters is I intend to enforce it. And so in Eisenhower's view, he had said everything that needed to be said, that there was no question this was the law of the land, there was no question it needed to go forward, and that he would support it. But nevertheless, he certainly did not use the bully pulpit a lot, and I fault him for that some in the book, that he certainly could have educated people more. He often said you have to do more than change laws, you have to change hearts and minds. And I think he may well have been right about that, but he probably could have done more to help educate and change hearts and minds. But in July of 57, as I say in the book, he does say he can't imagine sending in troops. And yet, I think that probably was misinterpreted by a number of people, Orville Faubus being one of them. I think Faubus sort of miscalculated and thought that was a green light and Eisenhower wouldn't challenge him at Little Rock. On the other hand, it is impossible to imagine any president saying anything else. I mean, if you think about it, what president is going to get up in a press conference and say, yes, I mean, first of all, there wasn't a crisis yet. No one had violated the law yet. So what president 2 months in advance of an event that hadn't happened would say, yes, I fully anticipate that, you know, the citizens of an American city are going to violate federal law and we're going to send in troops and you know, scare them and make them obey the law. It's very hard to imagine a president threatening an American city before a crisis had erupted. So I'm a little sympathetic to him on that. I do think it was carelessly worded and it did send the wrong message to people like Faubus, but I don't think he had any bad intentions. I think he just didn't want to threaten a crisis before there was a crisis. Mm-hmm. And let me also mention that Eisenhower, all along and almost alone among observers throughout the 1950s, did have this premonition, did have this fear that if he didn't move carefully, there just might be a little rock. And I think we should give him some credit for that, because leadership is not about just seeing things as they are today, but seeing things as they will be tomorrow. And I found an entry in his diary as early as July of 53, when he anticipates that there might well be a conflict between the police powers of the federal and the state government. And he fears, and he says often to his staff and his cabinet, if we don't move carefully, we could have another civil war. He uses that phrase several times. So he knows it's an explosive issue, which is why he tries to move incrementally, step by step over time, doing things like desegregating the Capitol, doing things like desegregating the military, where he has explicit authority, and where he can sort of move in an evolutionary posture as opposed to a revolutionary one. But the Brown ruling is a revolution, and so it changes the whole dynamics of the movement because it almost requires that he move more quickly and that the country move more quickly. And by the time of September 57, you have all of the ingredients for a very bitter brew in Little Rock, and that's what happened.
When John Kennedy was elected president, he got very significant support from African Americans. And this was something that I think Eisenhower was annoyed with, in the sense that he felt that his administration had made civil rights an important issue, had put it high on their list of priorities, but that somehow, in spite of that, they didn't have support of black voters. And he was very angry about that. Why was it the fact that the Republicans didn't get credit for what they had done on civil rights, and Richard Nixon didn't somehow work to Richard Nixon's advantage as he was running against Kennedy?
Well, there were a couple of things going on. One, of course, was John Kennedy calling Coretta Scott King when Dr. King was in prison in 1960. Nixon thought about saying something. Eisenhower thought about saying something. There was actually a draft statement written by Lawrence Walsh, who later became a special prosecutor in the 80s. He was a deputy attorney general for Eisenhower at the time. He actually wrote up a statement for Ike that basically said that, you know, he had great sympathy for Dr. King and this was unjust. And Walsh told me in an interview for the book that Eisenhower didn't disagree with it. He just feared that it would be seen as grandstanding to get in the middle of a law enforcement issue like that. So when Kennedy made his call, that combined with the perceived silence from the Eisenhower-Nixon team, I think led a number of African Americans to move over into the Democrat column. And as you say, Eisenhower complained in the aftermath of the election that he hadn't gotten enough credit for the things that he thought he had done, signing the Civil Rights Act of 1957, the first major civil rights bill since Reconstruction, acting decisively at Little Rock, desegregating the district. These were all very important steps, and he felt that the people had sort of forgotten it. It's interesting, though, that in the 60s, he continues to grow and evolve on the issue, and if anything, becomes even more progressive. He's working behind the scenes with President Kennedy after Birmingham to get Republican votes on civil rights legislation. He complains to Governor William Scranton. This has never been reported before until this book. Scranton has never commented on this publicly until now. He complains to Scranton in a private conversation that because of Barry Goldwater in 64, he fears for the future of the party. He fears that the party will become a white supremacist party. He complains to Goldwater to his face about his vote against the 64 Civil Rights Act. He's increasingly moving in a progressive direction, realizing that the business of creating an equal society is not yet done. So I think he may well, even as early as the 60 campaign and its aftermath, maybe regretted he hadn't done a little more, which might have explained why in the 60s, behind the scenes, he continues to work on the issue and move in the right direction on it. But, yeah, he definitely felt that he had an honorable record on the issue and was saddened that African-American voters did not respond to that more favorably in 1960.
We're almost out of time. We have maybe about a minute or so. I'm just interested in your reflections on Eisenhower and his standing among important Republican leaders. I'm sure one can say without fear of contradiction that for most conservative Republicans, their ideal leader was and continues to be Ronald Reagan. Having said that, how you think about how Republicans think about Eisenhower, and in fact, whether there is there some sort of a movement perhaps within Republican circles to polish his image a little bit and give him more of the credit to which he's due?
Well, I don't know how much of a movement there is. I do think that there is some rethinking of Eisenhower and his legacy going on, and I hope this book is a part of that. As I said earlier, in many ways, I think the book rediscovers Eisenhower as a small-c conservative, not a capital-C conservative, not that he had a list of ideologies that he was out promoting. On the contrary, conservatism, as Edmund Burke defined it centuries ago, is not an agenda, it's an approach. It's a way of managing change over time in a way that's consistent with institutions and traditions and culture. And I think that's exactly what Eisenhower was trying to do on civil rights. He wanted to move forward. He wanted to create a more equal society, but he wanted to do it in a way that didn't tear up what he saw as centuries of American tradition and sort of, as I say, he wanted an evolution, not a revolution. He also was very conservative in his outlook on life and on his outlook on the world. He believed that the world, since the time of the Garden of Eden, was a broken place, and you can't perfect it in this lifetime. You can manage it. You can improve it. You can change it. But you can't create a perfect society in this world. And in fact, some of his criticism in the late 60s of the Great Society was that it offered too much, that it said that it was going to fix every society's ills, it was going to fix every problem. And when those high expectations hadn't been met, when you still had racism, when you still had poverty, you had unrest. People were frustrated that things hadn't been perfected. So he shows very strong conservative streaks in much of his thought, and I think that conservatives of today and Republicans of today and even independents should take another look at that, because there's something to be said for a philosophy of limited goals, of not thinking you can change everything and fix every problem, but rather have a system in place for managing problems as they come up and trying to achieve progress in a step-by-step fashion.
We have to leave it at that. Pardon me for interrupting you there, Casey, but we're going to have to finish. The book is Ike's Final Battle, The Road to Little Rock and the Challenge of Equality by Casey Pipes. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.